The House comes to oral questions. Question number one, and the name of Teresa Ngobi.
Whakatele, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for Social Development and Employment, what additional support will be available for New Zealanders and their families from 1 April?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Carmel Sipolani.
Mr. Speaker, good news. I'm pleased to advise the House that from the 1st of April, 1.4 million New Zealanders will receive increased financial assistance. This includes those receiving a main benefit. Mr. Speaker, this government has made the largest increases in main benefits since the 1940s, including in Budget 2021 when we took the step of reversing the 1991 cuts to benefits. On 1st of April, we will lift them again by the rate of inflation. This will mean a couple with children on JobSeeker will receive an extra $40.86 per week, and a sole parent will receive $31.83 through their main benefit. On average, since 2017, couples receiving a main benefit and raising children are better off by $256 per week under this government, while a sole parent is $180 per week better off. I'm proud of the work we've done, but as we've always said, there's more to do, and we are laser-focused on delivering for all New Zealanders and getting the job done.
What will be available for older New Zealanders?
Mr. Speaker, it's not just main benefits that are rising. Superannuation will be lifted by the rate of inflation as well, ensuring our older New Zealanders are not left behind. If you are a couple on superannuation, you'll receive an extra $102.84 per fortnight. If you are single, living alone and receiving superannuation, you'll receive $66.86 more per fortnight. These lifts to the incomes of our seniors will go a long way to combating the global cost of living pressures.
What will working New Zealanders receive from 1 April?
Mr. Speaker, yet more good news. The 59,500 workers earning minimum wage will all receive a wage rise from $21.20 per hour to $22.70 per hour. But that's not all, Mr. Speaker. MB research shows 222,900 workers will receive a pay rise as a direct result of the shift in minimum wage. This is especially important for Māori and young people. 19% of people earning the minimum wage are Māori, while 61% are workers aged 16 to 24 years old. Alongside this, working for families will rise, meaning many working families will receive more each week. And the government's pay equity agreement with community nurses will also come into force, meaning 8,000 community nurses will receive more from the 1st of April.
Will there be any more help available for main beneficiaries and superannuants?
Mr. Speaker, yes, there will be. I'm pleased to remind the House that the winter energy payment will come into force on the 1st of May. When we first came into government, we recognised that older people and beneficiaries can sometimes have issues with the increased power costs during winter. This is why we introduced the payment. Also, yesterday in the House, we read the Child Support Pass on Acts Amendment Bill for the first time. We are on track to have this implemented by the 1st of July, and it will put more money in the pockets of over 41,000 sole parents. Mr. Speaker, this is a government which is delivering on our promise to lift incomes, reduce poverty, and tackle the cost of living crisis.
Supplementary, Chris Bishop.
Can she confirm that further interest deductibility changes also come into effect on April 1st, thus raising costs for landlords and putting more pressure on tenants who are the collateral damage in this government's war on landlords?
Mr. Speaker, I certainly can't confirm that, and mostly because I don't have responsibility for that as the Minister for Social Development.
Question number two, Brooke Van Velden.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Housing and reads as follows. How many additional permanent and fixed-term full-time equivalent staff were employed by Kāinga Ora in December 2022 as compared with December 2019? And how many additional homes did Kāinga Ora manage in December 2022 as compared with December 2019?
Just a minute. The Honourable Barbara Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On behalf of the Minister, I am advised that there were 1,361 additional staff and 4,628 additional homes.
Supplementary. How can she justify Kāinga Ora increasing its staff count by over 1,350 FTE staff in 3 years, an increase of 74%, when the number of homes managed in the same time period only increased by 7%?
Kāinga Ora has been given a much broader mandate to help meet the government's housing priorities. Kāinga Ora has transformed from a state house seller to a state house builder to leading the largest urban regeneration ever undertaken in New Zealand. Kāinga Ora staff costs have been very stable as a proportion of total spend.
Supplementary. How is Kāinga Ora's establishment of an additional 455 management positions between October 2019 and January 2023 not representative of a bureaucracy out of control?
The increase in staff matches its vastly increased work programs. The majority of the growth in staff have been in frontline teams that support customers and in the construction and urban development and planning areas. It is also delivering a range of new functions and accountabilities under the legislation. These include the teams which are helping drive the increase in housing supply and the large-scale urban regeneration of large-scale projects, which will deliver up to 40,000 homes over the next 15 to 20 years.
Supplementary. When will her government stop trying to compete with more efficient private developers by creating a bulging Kāinga Ora bureaucracy at the taxpayers' expense?
I refer the member to my previous answers, and I also add Kāinga Ora people costs as a proportion of overall expenditure is declining and will continue to decrease over the next few years when balanced against the continued growth in houses built and developments completed.
Question number three, Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and asks, does he stand by his statement that in 2021, Stuart Nash's then ministerial office consulted the office of the then Prime Minister on an Official Information Act request release where that email had been identified as part of that release? If so, why was that request release escalated to the Prime Minister's office for consultation?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Prime Minister, to the first part of the question, yes. To the second part of the question, on occasion, ministerial staff provide information relating to Official Information Act requests to the Prime Minister's office on a no surprises basis. I've accepted the apology of the staff involved and believe this was an oversight. Staff in the Prime Minister's office deal with large volumes of information every day, and errors of judgment do occur. However, on behalf of the Prime Minister, I've made my expectation clear and don't expect such an error to occur again.
Does the Prime Minister really expect New Zealanders to believe that one of the most highly ranked members of staff in the Beehive was that ignorant of Cabinet rules?
Mr. Speaker, human error is something that occurs everywhere, including in the Beehive, Mr. Speaker. The advisers receive significant amounts of documents that they need to wade through. Clearly a mistake was here. They underestimated what was in front of them, but it was an honest mistake.
Isn't it in fact the case that this was not one bad decision by one staff member, but part of a culture of cover-up?
Absolutely not, Mr. Speaker.
Why didn't the staff member involved, with knowledge of the email, come forward with it 2 weeks ago when the Prime Minister sought assurances that there were no further breaches of the Cabinet Manual by Minister Nash?
Mr Speaker, I would be speculating with regards to answering that question, but can only assume that given the copious amounts of documents they've had come through, that it wasn't front of mind that that was an issue. They underestimated at the time the significance of what was in front of them, but it was an honest mistake.
Isn't it actually the case that the Prime Minister's office saw the email and instead of doing the right thing, actively chose to cover it up by refusing to release it under the Official Information Act?
No, Mr Speaker, that's absolutely not the case. I also will say that ultimately all ministers have responsibility for signing off Official Information Act requests. We receive advice from advisers, but ultimately it is the minister's responsibility.
Was the Official Information Act request in question one from Newsroom that on June 8 requested all correspondence since 2020 between Minister Nash and his political donors? And if so, why wasn't the email released?
Mr Speaker, I believe in response to the first part of the question, yes. In response to the second part of the question, ultimately, ministers have to sign off Official Information Act requests, and that minister at the time made the decision that it wasn't within scope.
Who decided it was out of scope? The Prime Minister's Deputy Chief of Staff or Minister Nash?
Ministers ultimately are responsible for signing off Official Information Act requests. That member knows that is the case. You can get advice from advisers, but ultimately it is the minister's signature on that.
What is the point of consulting the Prime Minister's office if they don't have the ethics and understanding of cabinet rules to urge ministers to release information in compliance with the Official Information Act?
I reject the premise of that question. The staff involved made a mistake, and ultimately the minister is responsible for signing off on Official Information Act requests.
Why isn't the Prime Minister taking this opportunity to front up and make it clear that this was an egregious breach of the Official Information Act, which involved a conspiracy between a minister's office and the Prime Minister's office to decide to hide information from the New Zealand public?
Order, with a couple of things. I reminded members yesterday and I'll remind them today. Members might not like the question being asked, but they are asked in silence. And the minister, point of order, the Honourable Dr. Duncan Webb.
The member used the word conspiracy. Speaker's ruling 1772 says that members can't make implications or imputations in questions that go to matters that could be interpreted as misconduct or corruption, and that seems to meet that test.
Okay.
Nicola Wallace speaking to the point of order.
And my knowledge of the dictionary is such that I think a conspiracy is when people work together on an agreed strategy. And I did not use or imply corruption.
The Honourable Grant Roberts.
Mr Speaker, yesterday you admonished me and others in the House around interjecting and so on, and you made the point in doing so that you operate a different approach to questions, which I accept and understand, that you allow questions to be asked, and if they're out of order or not within responsibility, then a person can get up and say that. Mr Speaker, what you saw from us was a reaction to that being taken to a series of questions involving unparliamentary language and unparliamentary language that also goes to the integrity of both MPs and also, Mr Speaker, members of staff who cannot answer. And, Mr Speaker, I appreciate the style of chairing that you have, but I think what you saw was a response to the fact that we believe there has to be a limit even for that, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable James Shaw.
Just to be helpful, a conspiracy, according to the Oxford Dictionary, is a secret plan by a group to do something unlawful or harmful.
Anytime the House is ready, when the Speaker is on his feet, it would be very helpful. Thank you. Right. The Honourable Grant Robertson is correct, and I have let things go. I think I'm going to make a new alteration to the way that I have presided over question time. At least one part of the question should be in order for it to be valid. That question contained an imputation, and I am ruling it out of order. Do you have further supplementaries? Question number four, Rachel Brooking.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, Statistics New Zealand reported yesterday that labour productivity rose 2.2% in the year ending March 2022. That represents the largest growth since 2010. Labour productivity measures the quantity of goods or services or output produced per hour of labour. The rise in labour productivity reflects that output rose 5.4%, a faster rate than the 3.1% increase in labour inputs. Mr. Speaker, as I've previously said in the House, we know that 2023 is a difficult and challenging year for many New Zealanders, but this data is further evidence of the fact that New Zealand faces these challenges in a strong position with a more productive economy and near record low unemployment that will help New Zealanders deal with cost of living pressures.
How important is the impact of productivity on the economy?
Mr. Speaker, the challenge of higher productivity is a long-term one for New Zealand and other countries. And despite this positive report, we know that it is an ongoing challenge. But the government's strong commitment and investment in skills and training, research and development, industry development plans, the signing of free trade agreements and other efforts are important factors in helping lift our productivity over time, which in turn delivers higher skilled, higher wage jobs and builds a more inclusive, sustainable and resilient economy.
Other reports has he seen on the economy?
Mr. Speaker, the jobs market continues to support the economy. Statistics New Zealand reported that employment rose in February 2023 with filled jobs up 0.4% or 8,391 to 2.34 million compared to January 2023. The majority of gains were in the services industries, followed by the goods producing industries. On an annual basis, the biggest gains were in accommodation and food services, followed by transport, postal and warehousing and professional services. There were gains in nearly all age groups, and this was also led by the number in the 15 to 19 year old age group.
What reports has he seen on confidence in the labour market and its impact on the economy?
Mr. Speaker, confidence in the employment market has improved. The Westpac McDermott Miller Employment Index rose 1.5 points to 109.5 in the March quarter. A number above 100 represents optimism. Confidence improved in most regions, including in the cyclone-affected regions of Tairawhiti and Hawke's Bay, where it has been driven by perceptions of upcoming job opportunities. Mr. Speaker, we continue to see opportunities in regions across New Zealand.
What reports has he seen on the international context for the economy?
Mr. Speaker, the OECD's latest economic outlook report projects that global growth will slow from 3.2% to 2.6% in 2023. These are below trend rates for global growth, and the OECD warns that the outlook remains fragile. New Zealand's prospects will not be immune to what happens overseas, but we are well positioned to face the challenges ahead. And it is worth noting, Mr. Speaker, that our economy is 6.7% bigger than it was before COVID. This is not something all other countries can say. We have a solid set of government books, low unemployment, growing exports and a rising number of tourists. We must continue to take a balanced approach to support New Zealanders and invest in strong public services.
Question number five, Chris Bishop.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for the Environment, does he agree with the Cabinet Minute? It stated, quote, "Now is not the time for regulatory uncertainty or to impose new costs on businesses and households. Is he confident the natural and built environment spatial planning bills are consistent with that statement?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable David Parker.
Yes and yes. The repeal and replacement of the RMA will make the planning system better, faster and cheaper for businesses and households. There is much more cost and uncertainty under the existing RMA than there will be under the new system. The regulatory analysis, which was independently prepared and tabled in the House with the bill, shows savings for businesses and houses and households of 19% per annum compared to the status quo. This is around $150 million per annum and billions over time.
Why is he pushing ahead with bills that will make it more difficult to build wind farms, as stated by the Wind Energy Association, and are the biggest single barrier to decarbonising our economy, as stated by Contact Energy?
Mr Speaker, there are some fair detailed points in those submissions that I'm sure will be considered by the Select Committee. But many years of work have gone into these reforms. There have been reviews by the Property Council, Infrastructure New Zealand, the Northern EMA, the Waitangi Tribunal, LGNZ, the Randerson Review, the Select Committee Inquiry on Core Provisions, the Efficiency Review by Independent Experts, plus the current Select Committee process. Everyone's working hard to take into account the likes of those submissions and further improve the bills based on the very detailed and thorough submissions received. But it is time to finish the job and drive it through.
How will the inclusion of everything consented under the new RMA having to uphold and protect, quote, te aronga o te taiao, an entirely new legal term, contribute to regulatory certainty?
The new purpose statement makes it clear that after natural biophysical limits are achieved, development is enabled. We've stripped out amenity, matters of subjective taste as opposed to biophysical outcomes from the purpose of the Act, and we are better enabling development as well as adequately protecting the environment. The definition makes that clear.
What does he say to submitters on the RMA 2.0 that have warned, like the Chief Justice, of, quote, extensive litigation following the reforms? And how on earth will this help make it easier to get things done in this country?
The legislation is taking care to carry forward the most important court decisions that arose out of controversies in Marlborough Sound, where the King Salmon decision, in the end, after many decades of uncertainty under the RMA, found that there is a hierarchy, the Act, then national direction, the planning framework, then plans. That hierarchy is both preserved and made clearer under the new regime.
Supplementary, the Honourable Grant Robertson.
Why does the Minister think that after 6 years he will be able to show a reform of the RMA, whereas a previous government had 9 years and wasn't able to do it?
Order. I've ruled that out of order. Question number six, Dan Rosewarne.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Veterans. What is the government doing to support veterans?
The Mr. Honourable Speaker, Mika
Whaitere. Mr Speaker, with the indulgence of the House, may I welcome students from Hokarere Māori Girls College, whose Estelle-based college was completely devastated in the recent floods. Mr Speaker, in response to the question, tomorrow the government's April 1st adjustments will come into effect, and this will see the New Zealand superannuation increase by over $100 for a couple per fortnight and nearly $70 for individuals. What this means for our veterans and their whānau is an increase for those on the veterans' pension. Tomorrow's adjustments will help 880,000 people receiving New Zealand's superannuation and more than 5,500 on the veterans' pension.
Supplementary, what else have we done to support the RSA, veterans and their families?
Mr Speaker, the government recognises the value of the services the RSA provides, and for the past 4 years, with a grant of $250,000 annually, we have supported the RSA to help them do what they do best, provide welfare and support for our servicemen and women and their whānau. Recently, I made the decision that this funding will continue for the next 3 years. In addition, in 2020, during COVID, the government supported the RSA with a one-off grant of $2.53 million so they could continue to provide welfare support to veterans and whānau during the pandemic.
Supplementary, what have we done to support the well-being of our veterans?
Mr. Speaker, many veterans leave service and transition into civilian life successfully, but others experience mental health and or addiction issues. He Ara Oranga, a 2018 report to a government's inquiry into mental health and addiction, identified veterans as a vulnerable group. However, a framework was never developed to address their needs. In 2021, Veterans Affairs began the process of building a framework that brought together key defence and health organisations, veteran advocacy groups, health practitioners and veterans to focus on the mental health and wellbeing of veterans and their families.
Supplementary, how did the government respond to the He Ara Oranga report to the government?
Mr. Speaker, in 2022, we launched the new framework to address mental health and wellbeing for our veterans called Te Arataki mo te Hauora Ngākau mo ngā Morihu a tū me o rātou whānau, the Veteran, Māori and Whānau Mental Health and Wellbeing Policy Framework. This framework identified what was needed and, just as importantly, it looked at the evidence about need and responses. It also identified where work needed to be done and what are the sorts of interventions that actually do make a difference for our veterans. This framework, along with the increase announced to superannuation and veterans' pension, is just another step by this government improving the quality of life for our veterans and all those that serve our country.
Question number 7, Dr. Shane Reti.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Health, has she seen St John ambulance data released this week showing that the amount of time ambulances are ramped while waiting to admit patients to hospital emergency departments has more than trebled since 2019, and are ambulances being used as ED waiting rooms?
The Honourable Dr. Aisha Verrill.
In answer to the first part of the question, yes. In answer to the second part, no. Although ambulance handover delay does happen when it is determined to be clinically necessary, and work is underway to reduce emergency department pressures and address this issue.
What responsibility does she take, if any, for Auckland Hospital on March 6, diverting 6 ambulances to other hospitals because its ED was full, with ED docs saying that every bit of corridor and a recreational space was full of people still on their ambulance stretchers?
Mr. Speaker, since I have been Minister of Health, I have established the winter preparedness or response to the acute demand in our hospitals as a priority. There is a number of measures underway to address the demand that is in our hospitals following on from COVID. As I've already said in the House, that includes a comprehensive flu and COVID vaccination programs, measures within our hospitals to make sure flow of patients in and out of them are maintained, plus collaborative work with community partners, including St John's and primary care, to make sure that all opportunities to keep people out of hospital are maximised.
How was her inability to know how many staff vacancies there are at each emergency department contributing to EDs saying that they are under-resourced?
Mr. Speaker, I don't believe that is the response to the written parliamentary questions that member has submitted.
Supplementary, why has the number of people waiting more than 24 hours in emergency departments tripled since Health New Zealand was formed?
Mr. Speaker, the relevant trends in interpreting that data is that there has been an increase in acute demand since the pandemic. This has been seen in a number of countries, and for example, the relevant stats for ambulance ramping in the UK are 5 times worse than they were pre-pandemic. This is a global trend with increased demand for healthcare, and we are determined to address it.
Supplementary. Have the international countries she has just referenced also undertaken major structural change of their health system?
Mr. Speaker, the opportunity to address acute demand in our health system is maximised by having a single national service. And the member will see a number of initiatives that were developed at a local level be rolled out nationally because of our new joined up health system.
Question number 8, Nisa Chen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for Youth, what recent reports has she seen evaluating the outcomes of programs designed to support and empower rangatahi?
The Honourable Willow Jean Prime.
Tēnā koe te mangau te whare, and au mihi to all of the rangatahi that are in the audience today. Mr. Speaker, I have recently received the Term 4 2022 update on the Akonga Youth Development Community Fund, which builds on previous pleasing progress reports. The Akonga Fund was set up to help mitigate the risks of disengagement from education for at-risk Akonga, and it's designed to support and empower those who have had their education impacted by COVID-19 and who have had no pathway into further training or employment. As has been previously reported, that as the end of Term 3 2022, over 6,200 akonga had engaged with funded programs and that had exceeded our original goal of 5,500 akonga engaging with the program by the end of 2022. Today I am pleased to inform the House that the success of Akonga Fund is further highlighted in the Term 4 report, with 6,743 akonga having engaged with the program at the end of 2022. Two key themes emerged, showing increased support for rainbow akonga and promoting whānau and community connection.
Supplementary, what examples did the report show regarding the theme of promoting whānau and community connection?
Mr. Speaker, of those who exited an Akonga Fund program, 96% developed stronger connections with their community. The recent activities of three providers show how this has been done and in really creative ways. For example, here in Wellington region, alongside Upper Hutt Community Youth Trust, Akonga worked with Forest and Bird to plant more than 60 new trees in Upper Hutt. Another great initiative, which I personally love, was from the Southern Youth Development Trust in Dunedin, who ran a bike recycling program with Akonga. They recycled around 200 bikes, and the money was used to buy helmets for people who are unable to afford them. And the Mata Puna Trust ran a community painting project with Akonga, where they helped clean up graffiti in the community while also meeting their plans post-family group conference and allowing them to be discharged from the court or youth justice.
Further supplementary, how did the report show that Akonga Youth Development Community Fund providers supported rainbow akonga?
Mr. Speaker, members of the rainbow community in Aotearoa, New Zealand often face a range of complex issues and are overrepresented in statistics around mental health and discrimination. In Term 4 2022, three Akonga Youth Community Development Fund providers highlighted their work to support and connect this cohort. Triple Summit Services Limited brought together a small group of rainbow akonga to explore the rainbow community, building confidence and connections and supporting them to feel heard. Te Ora Hau o Tautahi Incorporated ran a group named Kanoro Ropu to support rainbow akonga in its community. And the Horo Whenua Learning Centre Trust ran a rainbow-specific program which was met with the enthusiasm and positive feedback from akonga.
Supplementary, what feedback did the report contain from those who took part in the Akonga Fund program?
Mr. Speaker, through this report we have heard from kaimahi, from akonga and from teachers who all support the positive difference the Akonga Fund programs have been making in the lives of our young people. One akonga told us that they learned skills which I needed for job interviews and how to communicate well. My mentor was amazing and set up the interview for me where I got my first job. One kaimahi said, we have completed an incredible year of wānanga, and in the words of some of the rangatahi, it has not been just life-changing, but a life-saving one. And as the House can see, the Akonga Fund has resulted in our rangatahi having an increased level of engagement in their learning and aspiration for their future, and having transitioned to further training or employment. Outcomes I think we can all be proud of.
Amazing.
Question number 9, Erica Stanford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Education, does she stand by her statement when asked if she could explain how it is fair for one child in one school to get an hour of maths a day, as recommended by the Royal Society, while a child in another school the same age gets far less? Oh yes, I absolutely can. If so, does she accept this variation has contributed to the widening gap in maths achievement for New Zealand students?
The Honourable Jean Tanetti.
Yes and yes.
A supplementary question, Mr Speaker. Why did she say on Tuesday that some teachers will have an approach to teaching maths that will mean they don't need to teach an hour a day? When the Royal Society experts recommended an hour of maths a day, regardless of the way in which maths is being taught.
Mr Speaker, the Royal Society in their report, and it was a government commissioned report, made 14 recommendations, and this government, instead of being focused on one, is focused on all 14 of them. I made the statement on Tuesday, Mr Speaker, because of research that shows that, and I will quote Dr Sarah Iono's research, that says 1 hour per day of focused teaching for each core subject is developmentally inappropriate for most children in the primary school sector, end quote. The research shows giving students information in small chunks at a time gives the brain time to process the information and continue to practice it. Accumulatively, Mr Speaker, that could add up to an hour of maths a day or even more. That is why National's outdated policy of sitting kids down with a pen and paper for an hour isn't an effective way to teach maths. The science has moved on.
How will she guarantee that every primary and intermediate school child across New Zealand will get the same amount of time learning maths every day to ensure that they are mastering the basics?
Mr Speaker, the Royal Society in the report that the member keeps referencing notes that most teachers are already teaching 3 to 5 hours of maths a week and 20% are actually teaching 7 hours of maths a week. But what the point that the member is missing is lifting maths is not about clock watching, it's about quality teaching.
If a teacher follows the recommended maths teaching methods in her proposed common practice model, which includes supporting student relationships with maths, which encompasses feelings and emotions related to maths, and addressing issues of power, social justice and equity, will this method require less than an hour of maths per day for all students, as she suggested on Tuesday?
Mr Speaking, the common practice model will be in place from next year and will ensure that maths is taught consistently from Kaitaia to Invercargill. What the common practice model might actually do is actually show that the amount of teaching will be prescribed as well, but we are not at the point of making those policy decisions at this point in time. We are concentrating on quality teaching, not clock watching.
Question number 10, the Honourable Julianne Genta.
Tēnā koe, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Transport. Does he agree with advice from Waka Kotahi that providing an additional Waitemata road crossing would result in over 3,000 additional vehicles entering the city centre compared to a light rail-only crossing? If so, will any of the options proposed, which all include additional road lanes, reduce congestion?
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Half of the Minister. The Waitemata Harbour Connections Program is focused on delivering as quickly as possible a future-proof solution for people wanting to travel across the Waitemata by car, bus, light rail, walking, cycling or truck. The scenarios released today consider both the needs of Aucklanders to get in to the city centre but also through the city. It is correct that Waka Kotahi's advice on one of the five options is as the Member states with respect to the number of vehicles entering the city at the AM peak, but they also advise that there will be a reduction in congestion in that option. In answer to the second part of the Member's question, updated private vehicle demand projections will be provided when the preferred option is confirmed in mid-23. However, as I say, the indicative work on the option the Member has raised shows that congestion will be reduced.
How will congestion be reduced if there are additional cars on the roads at peak time?
Mr Speaker, it's not just a peak time analysis, as I'm sure the Member well knows.
Does he agree with advice from Waka Kotahi that the road connections either side of the Auckland Harbour Bridge cannot carry any more private vehicle trips in the peak periods? If so, how will adding further car lanes and inducing more vehicles into those roads help congestion in the city centre?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, the focus here is on the resilience of the entire network in the Auckland area. Obviously, as I've already stated, the focus is not just on people coming into the city, it is also on people going through the city. Also, Auckland has seen in recent times the importance of resilience in the network, including with regards to the Harbour Bridge itself, which requires support to be able to continue to play its role. So it has to be an integrated solution that is adopted.
How can the public meaningfully engage on the options proposed without seeing their projected impact on tailpipe emissions?
Mr. Speaker, these are scenarios that the public can engage upon. There is frank assessments of them already, both the pros and the cons of various options that people can engage with, and I'm sure Aucklanders will be keen to do so.
Why is such an outrageously expensive, complex project with such a poor economic case, a BCR well below 0.5, a priority when we need to be investing urgently in projects that actually give New Zealanders low-carbon transport options right around the country?
Mr. Speaker, I reject various of the assertions in that question. What's attempting to be done here is to make sure that we have an integrated transport plan for Aucklanders, one that we give certainty to them and those that will help construct it, and one that does support the government's overall goals that include the work around climate action, but also include making sure that we provide resilient cities.
Point of order, I seek leave to table the most recent benefit cost analysis for these options, which is 0.2 and 0.3.
Is that publicly available?
It doesn't seem like the ministers have read it.
It is available.
The member will stand, withdraw and apologise.
Ah, stand, withdraw and apologise for presenting facts.
Now I'm considering what I'm going to do. That was deliberate. The member will leave the chamber. Question number 11, Maya Lubeck.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Courts and asks, what progress has been made to reduce delays in the coronial system?
The Honourable Reno Tirikatan.
Mr. Speaker, yesterday saw the passing of the third reading of the Coroner's Amendment Bill. I'd like to thank my colleagues across the House for their unanimous support. The government is committed to improving the coronial system and the experience of families who engage with it. The new law will reduce delays through a number of measures, including the establishment of a new coronial position known as the Associate Coroner. The Associate Coroner will help to ensure that coronial cases are, where possible, dealt with promptly and efficiently, while not adversely affecting the quality of coronial findings, the judicial independence of coroners, and adherence to law. Since 2014, there has been a significant increase in the number of active coronial cases and time taken to conclude them. The measures in the bill will address these delays for grieving families.
Supplementary, how will this bill support coroners in their work?
Mr. Speaker, associate coroners are able to exercise almost all of the duties, functions and powers of a permanent coroner. In practice, associate coroners will primarily undertake duty coroner work within the first 48 hours after death and will be responsible for some of the more straightforward coronial investigations. This will free up coroner time to be utilised for more complex cases, in particular cases requiring an inquiry to be opened, and cases where it is in the public interest for a coroner to make recommendations to avoid similar deaths in future.
Supplementary, have any other positions been established to support coroners?
Mr. Speaker, yes, they have. Budget 22 saw a package of investment to improve the coronial system, including the establishment of the Clinical Advisors Team. Clinical advisors will work alongside coroners and pathologists to ensure coroners have high-quality clinical information to support their decisions. This will contribute to improving efficiency of coronial cases. This month has seen the appointment of the first Chief Clinical Advisor working with the Coroner's Court, and a full team of clinical advisors will shortly follow.
What other work is being undertaken to improve the coronial system?
Mr. Speaker, in addition to the bill, the Ministry of Justice has a broader work program underway to further improve timeliness of coronial processes and the coronial experience for families. These work streams include responsiveness with respect to tikanga Māori and improving the Ministry's case management system. The Improving Coronial System Budget 2022 initiative provided $28.4 million in funding, which is funding new permanent coroners, associate coroners and clinical advisors. All this work is aimed towards achieving, where possible, more timely completion of coronial findings while ensuring the public interest continues to be well served across the coronial system.
Question number 12, Matt Ducey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health and asks, why has the Year 3 stocktake of the Budget 2019 Mental Health and Addiction Package found the delivery status of the Mental Health Infrastructure Program has, quote, not meaningfully improved, end quote, since the previous Health Minister, Andrew Little, said he was, quote, extraordinarily frustrated, we seem to be a long way behind actually getting a shovel in the ground, end quote, and why did the $30 million allocated to support delivery result in a finding that the program has not accelerated and estimated completion dates are unlikely to be met?
The Honourable Dr. Aisha Verrill.
Mr. Speaker, to the first part of the question, the report was written in June 22 and since then solid progress has been made. I am advised by Te Whatu Ora that many of the recommendations in the report have been implemented or are well underway. I am advised that of the 16 mental health infrastructure projects, two are complete, eight are in construction, four in planning and two are in the business case stage. I understand my colleague's, Minister Little's, frustration. COVID has been disruptive to project delivery. Inflation, demand for skilled workers and supply chain disruptions have had flow-on effects to government infrastructure projects. In response to the second part of the question, $30 million was ring-fenced to accelerate projects. Some of this money has been spent where it was able to be used to materially progress delivery. For projects in later stages, such as detailed design, or reaching the point of contractor procurement, there is limited scope for acceleration.
Which of the following from the report has contributed most to delays? The mental health project with incorrect costs due to the wrong number of beds, the project with the wrong site, or the one with a business case with no plan or timeline?
If the member is referring to seismic issues that have been discovered in one of the sites, I think that it's a very legitimate reason to readjust a project. There are a number of reasons for those delays, some of which were outlined in my primary answer.
Supplementary. What is her response to the report's findings that, quote, a light-touch approach by consultants resulted in unrealistic costings, budget escalation and over-optimistic schedules, end quote?
I would characterise one of the themes of the report as identifying in our disseminated health system a lack of capacity for infrastructure projects, which has been addressed through the centralisation of oversight of infrastructure in Te Whatu Ora. The visibility of projects, their risks and the capability for leading them has been substantially improved.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order.
The question I asked was about the consultants' work. That wasn't answered.
It was the question was definitely addressed.
Supplementary. Why has the implementation unit nearly 2 years since being tasked with reviewing mental health projects admitted they don't have the appropriate expertise by calling in the Infrastructure Commission?
Mr. Speaker, we have substantially improved the expertise dedicated to supervising these projects. And as I said in my primary answer, a number of them are being built now.
Member, that concludes oral questions.